Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce once again Rabbi Francis Nataf, who's a Jerusalem-based educator and thinker. He's the author of two books of contemporary Torah commentary. It's the Redeeming Relevance series, which is on sale right outside this hall, and I heartily recommend the books. He's as well the author of numerous articles on Bible, Jewish thought and education. He was the director of Jewish studies at the Pre-Collegiate Learning Center of New Jersey, and he's now working on a book of Jewish political thought. Please welcome Rabbi Nataf.
Good morning again, for those who I've seen before, and good morning for the first time for those who have not yet seen. I'm just starting, and I'm going to go right into an exercise. There is a sheet that's being passed out with some anonymous quotes. And I want you to look at the quotes. And I realize it's a bit unfair, but to try to think who might be the authors of these quotes. Okay, so just take a couple minutes to engage in this exercise. And don't, you know, keep it to yourself. And I'll ask for suggestions in a minute. Okay, while you're looking at the quotes, Professor Malamuth is going to be handing out the identification of who said these statements. Or at least most of them. Anybody in the back want to guess still? Any of the statements? Okay, what I did. Is to take statements made by modernist Islamic scholars and to substitute the references to Islam by Jewish words. Right? For example, if you take a look at the first quote in both sections, I wrote in the anonymous quote, in the Haredi paradigm. But in fact, the original was in the Islamic Puritan. It really is Haredi, but it's Haredi in the Islamic world. In that paradigm, God is represented in earthly life by a set of laws, and human beings have no choice but to obey. And Haredim, or Puritans, if you will, insist that only the mechanics and technicalities of halakha define morality. There are no moral considerations that can be found outside the technical law, read halakha. Okay, this statement was made by Professor Khalid Abu El Fadl, professor at UCLA of Muslim law, prominent modernist, Islamic modernist in the West. He's written a number of books And what I did is to put it right next to a controversial figure, but certainly someone who identifies with modern Orthodoxy, Professor Tamar Ross, who says something very similar about Rabbi Meiselman as a representative of a certain approach to the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And she writes about not just Rabbi Meiselman, but many others who she takes to task. I'm not going to read through all of the quotes. But what I did is essentially the same for some of the other quotes, identifying first the author, who is a Islamic modernist, and comparing it to very similar statements made about the Jewish tradition by actually two speakers you have here today, Rabbi Cardoza and yours truly. So you can take a look at that more carefully afterwards. Obviously, there are some differences, but the general gist is actually quite similar. Now, many Jews are surprised to see this. In fact, when I mentioned to my wife that I was giving a similar talk on moderate Islam, she said, I guess it's going to be a very short talk. Right? We're not used to moderate Islam. And certainly because of the conflict that we're involved in the Middle East, so we're often very prone to accepting a harsh and not always justified critique of Islam as a whole, and certainly a fundamentalist Islam. So my goal in giving you these papers was twofold. Number one, to show you that such people do exist in the Muslim world. And I didn't pick isolated people that have no followings, but rather important scholars and thinkers. And secondly, to show you that they're dealing with many of the same issues that we in the modern Orthodox world are dealing with as well. So one of the things that I want to do before I start my talk, which is a comparison of modernist Islam, these voices in Islam, with modern Orthodoxy, is to put my cards on the table that I'm not coming to discuss Islam's view on Israel or on Jews, which obviously we have some issues about. But to lay my cards on the table that in general I have a rather positive view of Islam, and hopefully that's not too objectionable for anyone sitting in this room. But it comes as a result of exposure and research about contemporary Islam in particular and Islam more generally that I've undertaken as part of a larger research project that, as Dr. Malamud mentioned, I'm working in terms of comparative approach to religion and state in various religions. So I'm someone who has done some research, and could be there's someone in the room who knows more. I'm not presenting myself as an expert. But certainly someone who's has done a lot of reading and research on the topic. I've come to an understanding to see the bright side of Islam, and I think there is a tremendously bright side over there, and I think that ultimately that's what's attracting millions of Arabs and third world people and first world people as well in Europe. Especially that there are solid values that I think most Jews would respect, values of self-negation, which I know Dr. Hazzoni condemned as Christian earlier, but I don't think it's completely absent in Judaism, and certainly loyalty to God, rejection of human power, community, and compassion are all central facets of Islamic thought that often are not communicated so much in the West. So for me, I often sympathize with religions that express such values and feel that there's more that resonates in Orthodox religious traditions, at least those of the West, with our own tradition than when I encounter Western liberal thought. So I'm coming from that perspective, but I think it's not necessary to agree with the perspective I'm coming from. What I want to engage here is really in self-critique, in critique of modern orthodoxy. And it's often easier to critique oneself, and I'm speaking as someone who identifies very strongly with modern orthodoxy. It's often easier to critique oneself or one's community in an indirect fashion. And so I'm choosing to look at the shortcomings of modernist Islam, and through that, I mean, the name of the thought, the talk is Through the Looking Glass. Using what I propose to do is to use modernist Islam as a sort of looking glass and see what's going on that's wrong over there, and see whether we may not have some of the similar problems that they're encountering. So in modernist Islam, first of all, they're dealing with a lot of the similar issues that we in modern orthodoxy are dealing with. The questioning of traditional truth claims posed by academic study, in our case of the Bible, in their case of the Quran, but more generally of our tradition, our values, as well as traditional methodology. The questioning of what can be seen as parochial values, which is generally critiqued by a Western thought experiment that views itself primarily as universalist, that has values that apply throughout the world and consider man as man and not as belonging to different cultures or religions or nations. The need for tolerance is an issue that modernist Islamic leaders are dealing with, situation that is more pronounced and necessary in the global community, what's being called the global village recently, and simply a modus vivendi that's necessary in the modern multicultural state, which is being played out quite interestingly to the discerning viewer in Egypt, that there is a Muslim government that is trying to work within a realization that they belong to a multicultural society in Egypt proper, and certainly the more global community. They're also dealing with answering or responding to the Western approach to equality, which is not as pronounced in traditional religion, certainly in Islam, which often speaks about a more hierarchical vision in many situations. In any case, these are the issues that they're dealing with, and coincidentally or not, it's also the issues that many of us in the modern Orthodox world are dealing with as well. And the truth is that from my study, I've noticed that Islam is more fluid, meaning that the scholars that are dealing with these issues have more freedom than we in the Orthodox world do. I'm reminded of a joke of three great religious leaders coming together for an interfaith conference that's billed as the Summit Conference of Religions, and each one is going to make a giant step to bring these religions, these world religions, together. Of course, they have to make certain compromises in order to do so. And after much deliberation, so the Muslim leader declares with great emotion and great ambivalence that in order to advance this project, he, in the name of Islam, is going to give up the concept of jihad, of struggle, which is often violent struggle against heretics and others. So that's what he's going to do. And the Pope, who's also present there, he's so impressed and inspired that he decides he's going to do something no less great, and he decides that he's right there and then going to give up on the concept of the Trinity, because after all, that's creating problems for other world religions, and it's a great sacrifice to Christianity, but in the name of this great project, he's going to do it. So comes the rabbi who's been amazingly selected by all of the great rabbis, and he comes up to the plate, and he's also inspired, and he says that he's going to have to do something no less important in our own faith, that he's going to remove one of the Yakum Purkan Min Shemayas from the Sidur. Of course, when it comes time to signing, so it's also with great fanfare, and the leader of Islam comes first, signs, you know, with great applause and great fanfare. Same with the Pope, and the rabbi is getting ready, pen in hand. He drops the pen and says, "I simply can't do it." You know, for Jews to compromise and to change is extremely difficult, as we all know. The tools at the disposal of Islamic leaders allow for much greater flexibility. And one can consider this a weakness. In fact, they have a concept, I'll probably boggle the pronunciation, called Nashk, which is the possibility in their tradition of abrogating psukim, if you will, sentences from the Quran. Again, you can consider that a weakness, but there is this tool, which is obviously not used very commonly, but there's that freedom. Not suggesting we do that with the Torah, but all I'm saying is, by way of comparison, there is a great amount of flexibility that they have, and also the level of clerical authority over there is much more fluid than it is in the Jewish tradition. The power of the rabbis is much more in place than the place of the ulama, the scholars in Islam, has been challenged over the last two centuries to the point that knowledgeable laymen have much more of a say in Islam. But be that as it may, what I'm going to be talking about is not so much how they deal with their issues as specific issues, as much as whether or not they're successful, the modernist leaders, in carrying the day, or at least having significant influence in the Muslim world. And I think the perception that these people, in context, in the context of the hundreds of millions of people that follow Islam, to say that these leaders and their approaches have made significant headway, our perception that is not the case, I think, is largely true. Just did some research about some of these people's works, and one of the measures that I used is how many books do they sell? How many books do they sell, and who's buying them? And what I noticed is that many of these modernist Islamic scholars, first of all, live in the West. I mentioned Abu al-Fadl lives at UCLA, or in Los Angeles, teaches at UCLA. Abdullah An-Naim, I believe, is in Wisconsin, if I'm not mistaken. Another, the greatest disciple of Muhammad Taha, who's a great, actually a religious martyr, and outstanding religious leader in the Sudan. In any case, his greatest disciple, perhaps because he didn't want to be a martyr, moved to the United States. Tariq Ramadan was controversial, but ultimately also a modernist, lives in Switzerland, and so on and so forth. And their works are highly touted in the West, but to quote one scholar of the Middle East, Milton Vorst, he says about Abu al-Fadl, one of the modernists, the first quote that we saw, he says about his works that it will be studied with interest in the outside world, where, not coincidentally, he lives and works. In the Muslim world, he is likely to be ignored, if not vilified. And another expert, Stanley Kurtz, says that the approach may be popular at liberal schools of divinity and departments of religion at American universities, but I wonder how much appeal it will have for Middle Eastern Muslims. In fact, one of the authors themselves, Abdullah Naim, raises the obvious question by saying that it may appear presumptuous to expect a book that is written in English and is likely to be banned in some Muslim countries to have any significant impact in the Muslim world. He raises the question, but he doesn't really give a good answer to it. And in fact, I think the impact of these works and these scholars, some of them who do live in the Middle East, is quite limited. And if you compare that to someone like Said Qutb, who is the intellectual father of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, actually, died a number of years back. But his book, Milestones, which is something you should read, it's an important work. But in the Muslim world, it's not just an important work, but it's a work that's highly popular and sold millions upon millions of copies, and from what I read, over 2,000 editions. So certainly the impact of the more fundamentalist approach is much greater by this benchmark, but I think by all benchmarks. And even among Western Muslims, and there's a growing Muslim community in Europe, Gil Kapel raises, I think, a very interesting comparison to Eurocommunism in the 70s and 80s, where the French and Italian Communist parties were the largest parties of great influence in the West, were constantly looking over their shoulder to make sure that their positions didn't deviate too far from the orthodoxy of the Soviet Union. And I think that's true of what he calls, or he compares it to Eurocommunism, so which I've branded Euro-Islam. So what we see is that even though in some places and sometimes there a more moderate vision of Islam has come to the fore, is at the fore, by and large in the Muslim world, there's much greater influence from the more fundamentalist approach, and that the modernist Islamic leaders, at least in terms of their impact, are largely failing. And what I want to do is to analyze what could be the reasons for their failure. So many of the modernist Islamic leaders, even more so, this is not something new, even more so 100 years ago, people like Muhammad Abduh, who were writing about a new vision of Islam, which was more in consonant with Western thinking and modernity, certainly, looked to Luther. I mean, they said it explicitly. They looked to Martin Luther as a role model. They didn't subscribe to his beliefs, but they appreciated the ability that he had to reinterpret a religious tradition successfully. He was not alone, but certainly he was the most important figure in convincing half of Western Christianity, or more at the time, that in fact Catholicism had misinterpreted Christianity all the time, and that he was simply going to bring it back to its roots. Now, that's a tricky proposition, which we'll speak about for a minute, but what's important here, and what was important to the Islamic modernists, and still important to them, is that he was successful. He was able to convince people that his approach was, in fact, correct. I just want to, as an aside, just explain the notion for a second, or at least defend the notion that reinterpretation of a tradition can be more correct. As those of you in my last talk may remember that I suggested bringing novel approaches that in fact may be more valid than what is being practiced or thought in our contemporary situation. But perhaps take a more innocuous example, maybe for some of you it's not so innocuous, but on Pesach, many of you know that a lot of people like having large quantities of matzah at the Seder, saying that this is what the halakha requires, that we're required to have a gigantic piece of matzah in order to fulfill the mitzvah. Now that's based on the halakha of eating a kazayit which, for better or worse, translates into the size of an olive, like an olive. Okay, and granted, olives that they were talking about were presumably larger than the average olive we have today. But not so long ago, the Chazon Ish championed the position that, in fact, the dominant, I mean, almost the universal understanding of what a kazayit was mistaken. That there was a mistaken understanding of the Talmud, and he was coming to correct that misunderstanding. And that's been accepted through much of the Jewish world. And I'm not saying that to critique the Chazon Ish. On the contrary, what I'm saying is that in all traditions that I know of, the notion of reinterpretation as coming closer to the original perspective is acceptable. So that Luther was saying that his vision of Christianity was more correct than Catholicism is not a logical fallacy. The fact that it occurred well after a certain approach to tradition had been accepted doesn't mean that the original approach was actually closer to the source. And so too, that's what the Chazon Ish is saying when he says that in fact we were mistaken, and when much of the religious world accepts it and says yes, in fact it appears that he's right, that a mistake was made along the way, and that the original position was what the Chazon Ish is saying right now, and that we've been making a mistake all along. So that happens in all traditions. What's important about Luther is that he was successful. And therefore, I think the key is really moving over to that example and saying, well, what were the key components of Luther's success? And again, this is a much longer talk, and it's really subject of much writing. But for our purposes, I'm going to look at a couple of key factors which I think are lacking in modernist Islam. So now, number one, something that needs to be there for people of a faith or of a tradition to accept a novel interpretation is that it has a basis in the foundational texts. Again, going back to the Chazon Ish, the Chazon Ish looks back at various places in Talmud and says, look at what I'm saying, look what the text says, and it works. Okay, to take a contrasting example, which I actually have seen, believe it or not, is to say that, in fact, Judaism is proposing and supports the notion of polytheism, of many gods. That if you look in the Torah and you see it says, Naseh Adam, we will make man, many gods make man. And again, people have suggested this quite seriously. But the reason that most of us are going to laugh at such a suggestion, which actually Rashi brings up the possibility, quoting Chazal, that people would possibly say such a thing. But the reason we're going to laugh at such a possibility to say that, in fact, Judaism supports polytheism is because it goes against much too many texts in our tradition. It contradicts many, many statements throughout Tanakh and certainly in the Talmud and later writings. So to say that Judaism supports idol worship or polytheism is not going to fly. It simply flies in the face of foundational texts. And to give an example of where Luther actually set the stage for Western political thought, there's a statement that's repeated several times in the New Testament that one should give unto Caesar what is Caesar and give unto God what is God's. So Luther develops that idea and speaks about a city of God and a city of man, and obviously John Locke takes it further to contemporary notion of separation between church and state. So that tradition, both developed by Luther and Locke, has a foundation in Christian writings. It's not simply something that is off the wall and in contradiction to these foundational texts. Incidentally, I think that such a notion is, whether we like it or not, much more rooted in Christian tradition. And we'll speak about this on the panel perhaps later today, but the notion of separation of religion and state is not just in Islam more difficult to justify, but I think you will find that it's very difficult to find support for such a notion in Jewish foundational texts. And in fact, I think just the opposite, that it's the texts lead in a different direction. So I don't know how, to what extent Islamic modernists are justified in what they're saying based on their foundational texts. I'm an outsider to the tradition, and therefore it's hard for me to evaluate what is consonant with their tradition and what's not. One thing that discourages me or makes me believe that there are some problems there is the fact that the interpretations I see among these different scholars are often very radically different in their approach, and therefore I want, you know, that obviously makes one suspicious of how authentic their readings are. Something else that one picks up in the Lutheran Reformation is the piety and sincerity that one finds with Luther and with many of his followers. Now, this is a criteria that's obviously very difficult to measure. There's a joke Woody Allen says that he was in a metaphysics class and he confesses to having cheated by looking into his neighbor's soul. It's not so easy to do that, to determine, to measure, you know, how sincere is a person and how pious is the person really. Obviously, one is dependent upon external manifestations of piety and sincerity. Be that as it may, I think one of the critical determinants in the case of Luther and his followers, certainly the earlier followers, was that they had much to lose by rebelling against the Catholic Church. When the Catholic Church was dominant, certainly to disagree with it, Luther didn't realize that he would be successful. He was persecuted. He was persecuted and hidden away, essentially jailed. So that a willingness to pay the price is certainly a sign of sincerity. As we mentioned, with many of the Islamic modernists who have chosen to move to Western countries, so certainly taking a more modernist position is rewarded by the society that they've chosen to live in. And in general, I think that one senses, both in the writings of the leaders as well as in the proponents of these traditions, generally speaking, one sees, at least outwardly, less sincerity in terms of religious devotion. Again, as I mentioned, one of the great leaders was willing to pay with his life for it. So certainly one respects the sincerity of that particular leader, Muhammad Taha, in the Sudan. But if we were to generalize, I mean, the many, many leaders of the more fundamentalist approaches, such as Qutb, who I mentioned before, many members of the Muslim Brotherhood had been persecuted and jailed and suffered greatly for their beliefs in Egypt and in many other countries when this approach was less approved and less popular to governments and societies. So to say that the modernists are coming with the sort of sincerity and piety that one finds in Luther and his followers would be, I think, a stretch. And I think this is also a weakness in their desire to create a following amongst more Muslims, both in the Middle East as well as in the Western world. The last criteria, again, we're dealing on one foot here. The last criteria that I noticed I think is critical is zeal and passion. And again, this is not something that's easy to measure, but I think we can get a general idea. And in fact, if one looks at something that Ibn al-Fadl, one of the modernists, says himself, is the realization that the passion that exists in some of the more fundamentalist writings is simply not there. And if one reads Kutub's pathways, or excuse me, milestones, then one appreciates the passion of the writer. And again, if one can try to be objective while reading such a text, which has certain things that might upset us, if you look at the book as a whole, one sees a tremendous religious passion, which one does not see in many, I would say most of the modernist texts. And it reminds me a little bit of Simone Weil, who was actually a Jewish philosopher who died in the middle of World War II in Britain, of all places. And she drew very close to Catholicism. Right? She wasn't baptized, but she accepted Catholicism as her path in life, having come from an assimilated Jewish household. But what's interesting about her is that she had much contact with French intellectual priests, but that wasn't the draw that brought her close to Catholicism as much as her visit to Portuguese fishing villages, where she noticed a much greater intensity of zeal and passion and connectedness with spirituality than she saw in the more intellectual strains of Catholicism. And I would point out, going back to the resonance with foundational texts, that I'm not speaking about accuracy in the text. It simply can't scream out against what's obvious from the text. But I think in this case, and I have many disagreements with Tamar Ross, but I think in this case, her understanding of what works and what doesn't work to advance the feminist agenda in Orthodoxy is spot on, is completely correct. She writes that articles, like a famous article written a few years back about women's aliyot in the Eidah journal, simply have very little effect, no matter how well it was written and no matter how correct it may have been. I'm not saying it was, but let's assume that it was. Certainly was a very well-written and resourced and researched article, that this doesn't really affect what, quote, Judaism has to say, end quote, about women's aliyot, that in fact you're dealing with something that's much more subtle, that religious communities are living organisms with certain rules and modalities of change. And it's not simply by proving that we have a better understanding of the text that religions will change. And the variables that we brought forth, I think zeal and passion on the one hand and sincerity and piety on the other, are critical variables in Luther's success and critical variables in the influence of the Islamic fundamentalists on Islam today. And what's lacking with the modernists, with the Islamic modernists. Now, as I said at the beginning of the talk, all of this is not because of my interest in Islam, though I have an interest in Islam, but much more as a looking glass to criticize ourselves in modern Orthodoxy, and to examine whether some of the reasons that we're not really ascendant in Orthodoxy today, and that the Haredi world seems to have a much stronger voice in that which is understood to be mainstream Judaism, is perhaps because some of the same variables that keep back modernist Islam. So I'm going backwards in terms of the variables that I mentioned. First of all, in terms of zeal and passion, so quite frankly, this has been a central tenet in what I've tried to bring across. I'm not the only one, certainly many of us in the modern Orthodox rabbinate feel frustrated by our desire to see greater zeal and passion among our congregants in terms of the intensity of prayer, in terms of the hours devoted to Torah study, in terms of strictness of adherence to mitzvot, commandments. And it doesn't even have to be the same issues that resonate in the Haredi world, you know, as if we think that some of the issues that they're focusing on in terms of tzniut, in terms of modesty of dress, are overdone and artificial, there's certainly issues that we should be more concerned about, such as social justice, such as Lashon Hara, such as honesty in business, which I don't see being taken up with the same enthusiasm in the modern Orthodox world that various mitzvot that the Haredi world is concerned about is being taken up in that world. And perhaps it's not only a problem in the laity, perhaps the rabbinate is also to blame and does not show the same intensity and the same commitment and seriousness that the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox rabbinate, is able to broadcast. But it certainly is a problem, and certainly I'm not saying that everybody in the Haredi world is zealous and passionate about what they do. But if we are to generalize, I think that they would be viewed as more passionate than we in the modern Orthodox world. And from that perspective, I think Rabbi Lam, Rabbi Norman Lam, Chancellor of Yeshiva University, who is perhaps one of the most important leaders of the modern Orthodox world, his call that he once made, I remember, in Israel, for passionate moderation is a call that's very difficult for most to even understand. In terms of piety, so here too, as I mentioned before, it's very difficult to measure, but by and large, if we look at the modern Orthodox world, piety is not something that strikes us as its greatest strength, and certainly something that needs some work in most scenarios. As far as basis in the text, and certainly as someone who has suggested novel interpretations that are more in consonance with a modern approach to life and thought, and perhaps more acceptable from a Western perspective, it's hard for me to say that the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox understanding or interpretation of the text is more resonant and is more properly based than are those of the writers in the modern Orthodox world. But others have said just that, and for the sake of honesty, I should mention that to you. In fact, two great modern Orthodox scholars, not rabbis, but scholars, although I think the latter is also a rabbi, university professors both, the famous in academic circles, Professor Charles Liebman, who has since passed away, was considered the greatest, or certainly the most prolific, but I would say also the greatest sociologist of religion in Israel. He worked for many years, I think at Bar-Ilan University, if I'm not mistaken. So what he says is that in general, one of the reasons for the success of more conservative groups is in fact because they are more closely rooted to the text. He calls it a more organic or authentic interpretation of the text that one sees in fundamentalist circles, which leads to their success. Certainly we can think of what I mentioned before in terms of Rabbi Slifkin, the notion of the world being created in 7 days, literally, is certainly more rooted in the text. Whether it's correct or not is a different question, but Lieben would tell you that, in fact, one of the reasons it's successful and it's convincing is because it means what it says, and that is more convincing to the average layman. Another voice who says something similar, Gerald Blidstein, if I'm not mistaken, is still at Ben-Gurion University in the Negev. His context is speaking about the issue of the liberal state and more specifically, separation of religion from state. And he says the following about Jewish sources. He says, pursuing matters to their pure, consistent ends may demonstrate how irreconcilable the positions of halakha / Judaism and liberal democracy really are. Again, these are people who, if anything, would have an interest in showing that modern Orthodox interpretations of texts are very well rooted as opposed to what they're saying. So, though I am not in necessary agreement with what they said, I think it's important to bring them up as a possibility. But certainly in the other issues, I think we have clear and important impediments into the ascendancy or preventing the ascendancy of modern orthodoxy. Again, the issues of passion and zeal on the one hand and religious sincerity and piety on the other. And again, my particular interest is the question of religion and state, which we'll discuss more on the panel today. But I remember being in a forum that was convened, was brought together by a liberal Zionist Orthodox rabbi. And this came a couple of years ago when Yeshivat Har Bracha of Rabbi Melamed was being thrown out by the defense minister, Ehud Barak, from the Hesder Yeshivot Association for refusing to comply with certain demands that the army made of yeshiva students. So Rabbi Melamed took a stand, and the defense minister said, we can't have you supported by the defense establishment if you're going to make that stand. So the Hezda rabbis had gotten together to discuss this issue, and the rabbi that I spoke about convened this sort of town hall type of meeting where he brought different rabbis, all of which shared his vision, a more liberal vision of what the appropriate Jewish or certainly religious Zionist approach to the state of Israel. And one rabbi after another expounded, I think oftentimes for very good reasons, why there was really no conflict here, and that in fact one should be, from a religious perspective, supportive of the state of Israel. And this was I think a fairly mainstream audience, fairly typical audience. And what I noticed that though I was sympathetic with the speakers, the audience was getting angrier and angrier as each speaker spoke for what they viewed as a sort of Uncle Tom approach to the state, that in fact one should take a much stronger approach and much more fundamentalist, if you will, approach towards the state. And this was almost uniquely a religious Zionist, the Dati Lumi, which, for better or worse, is aligned or is understood to be aligned with modern Orthodoxy. And so that's, I think, a fairly accurate sense of the pulse of the nation, that even in the midst of modern Orthodoxy, Yeshiva University being an important case in point, there is much debate about the role of modernity and a questioning of whether, in fact, we are on the right road. So certainly, whether it's for the reasons I mentioned or not, we have a descendancy, a crisis of confidence in modern Orthodoxy to compete for leadership in Orthodoxy. And I believe that crisis of confidence and failure to swing the tide towards a more open vision of Orthodoxy, which I think is correct ideologically, and certainly more helpful on a practical level in building bridges with non-Orthodox groups within Israel and outside of Israel. But that vision, I think, is endangered or certainly threatened and weakened by many of the same variables that threaten and result in the lack of success in the modernist Islamic community. So in summary, and I'll open up for questions after this, in summary, I think what we saw as some of the important variables that led to the success of religious reinterpreters in Christianity, notably Luther and other leaders of the Protestant Reformation, on the one hand, compared to the lack of success in other groups that try to reinterpret religious traditions. And what's interesting is claims have been made, at least in Islam, that the fundamentalist approach is no less a reinterpretation. And I think the same is true in Judaism as well, that certainly the Haredi approach is a reinterpretation. I heard a cute story. I won't say the Gadol that said it, but it was a very, very important, a leading rabbi that had come to America. Was pretty much universally recognized as a leading rabbi. He passed away a few years ago. And he was asked by one of his students about the mirror escape to China during World War II. And the student was very surprised by what had actually happened when he heard that the rabbis, the Rosh Yeshiva, were against the Mir Yeshiva, or at least the students, and the Yeshiva as a whole, moving to China, but rather felt that was the appropriate response was to stay put. Nonetheless, the students, in fact, did move to China. You know, some of the rabbis followed, obviously. Or it could be some of the junior rabbis were part of the movement. But in any case, the Rosh Yeshiva, the leading rabbis, were not obeyed. So when the students asked this great rabbi in New York, how many years ago, he said, "I don't understand what happened to Das Torah." So the rabbi said, no, you don't understand. That was before Das Torah, right? So the fact is that fundamentalist approaches are often also reinterpretation. As I mentioned before, reinterpretation is not synonymous with falsehood. Reinterpretation can be, in fact, getting back to the correct roots and the correct original understanding of text or tradition. In the end, the question that we need to ask is the problem religious moderation itself? In other words, is it intrinsic to religious moderation, be it in Judaism or in Islam, that it prevents itself from zeal and passion and piety? It's a very important question. My feeling is that it's not intrinsic, but I think the onus of proof is upon us. And the question that we as moderates need to ask is whether that in fact is so. And more important, based on our track record, I think that we need to spend much more time, really work overtime, to show that we can in fact address these critical issues. Thank you. Okay, I'll take some questions. Again, the questioner needs to step up to the microphone. This is for posterity. You can go ahead. You can form a line if you want. That's fine. But otherwise, I can pick on people so you can enjoy chairs, whatever. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, there's one variable that you haven't mentioned, and I'd like to get your opinion on how important you think it is, and that's the variable of the individual personality. Because we know from a lot of situations that different people are turned on by different things. I think Rabbi Soloveitchik made that point from a Gemara that some people are more attuned to Talmud Torah and some people are more attuned to prayer. In the Shema, we have two paragraphs, one for people of a higher spiritual level, the first one, and the second paragraph for people who are not of such a high level. And we see it in the binary voting of the election tomorrow. Tomorrow or the next day?
Tuesday.
So I wonder if you would comment on that. I think, for me, it's a very, very important variable.
Sure. No, there's no question that, to be colloquial, different strokes for different folks. There's no question that modern Orthodoxy will attract a certain type of person, and the Haredi approach will attract another. The problem is that you need, in order to be an ascendant movement, you need to attract both quality, which the modern Orthodoxy and isomodernist Islam would pride themselves upon attracting, but you also need to attract quantity. It's not enough simply to say, well, we have our small little elitist club that often suffices for modern Orthodoxy. On a historical level, and this is another talk that I've given at other times, the Jewish people votes with their feet. And you need large, if you expect to have an impact historically, you need to be aware of what the needs of the masses are as well, and not simply assume that by attracting large numbers of Jewish intellectuals that you will be able to have a dominant role in the movement as a whole. Yes.
Based on your knowledge and study and so on, do you want to make any predictions for what the future is going to hold in the Islamic world? I mean, it's obviously something we're all interested in.
Yeah, you know what they say about prophecy in our time, it's given to fools. And so I don't know if that was a polite way of giving me your evaluation of my standing. I'm going to assume that's not. I'm honestly very interested. We all are. And as I said in passing, I'm fascinated by the Egyptian experiment. I think that historically there's a tension between Orthodox in more general, not just Jewish, Orthodox religious tradition, which is able and is really necessary for human existence on a spiritual level. And I'm not the only one. Serious sociologists, I think, Peter Berger makes such a claim, that we need serious religiosity on the one hand. On the other hand, we live in a situation where it's impossible for a religious group to take on a societal monopoly in terms of educational institutions, governmental institutions. It simply doesn't work on a practical level. So I think experiments in working through that tension are extremely valuable. I think that the trajectory that we have in the West, again, I think we're far too self-confident. I mean, people in the Western tradition, and someone, name skips, eludes me right now. I think many people in the West are far too self-confident and assume, Francis Fukuyama, it's not the person I was looking for, but writes an essay and I think later a book called The End of History. And in the essay, he claims that we've made it. As all societies are eventually simply going to take on the Western model, and that this is the end of history. We've attained, a shleimut. We've attained the model of society that is the best that mankind can come up with. I think it's highly problematic and very narrow-minded to make such a statement and take up such a position. So I'm interested by societies that are working and playing with the tension. You know, there have been other attempts at Islamic societies taking on power in the modern state, Iran being the most central, and certainly we have issues. We have issues with Iran on many levels, so that I find Egypt and some of the other countries also, Tunisia, which is a smaller country, which is sort of left the limelight, is run by a moderate fundamentalist Islamic party. So Tunisia, which has much more of a liberal political tradition than does Egypt, is also experimenting with this tension. I'm finding the tension fascinating, and I'm hopeful that they might come up with some new insights and sources of thought for ourselves. I mean, obviously, I would be even happier if the Jewish state were to come up with new models for coexisting between the two poles of this tension, which I think are here for the long run, the pole of Orthodox religious tradition on the one hand, and the need for a tolerant political state on the other. And as I said, from my perspective, we're far in any society, Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, from finding the answer. And so as someone who's interested by this tension, sees it as crucial, I'm just at the edge of my seat, and therefore hopefully optimistic that we'll see some surprisingly good things. Incidentally, in connection with the Muslim leadership of Egypt, I think we should take note of the strained but continued relationship that exists between the government of Egypt and the government of Israel, which is a big stretch for someone coming from, ideologically, coming from the roots of the Muslim Brotherhood. And we should not underestimate the significance of that. Okay, I've been given the sign for 2 minutes, half a minute ago, so I have one quick question. Yeah, go ahead. Yes, you. But you have to go to the microphone.
I just want to ask about the question of piety. Are you distinguishing it from passion? And in particular, because I think one of the issues is that modern orthodoxy is perceived by other segments of, let's call it orthodoxy, however we define that, as being less pious, and therefore seen almost as a gateway into what are still the dominant sectors of Judaism in North America, which are, again, relatively speaking, less pious, however you define that. So it seems to me that there's a kind of a natural tilting away from us to either one side or the other because we represent moderation.
Right. So again, the question is to what extent is that intrinsic? And my hope and challenge to ourselves is that I believe that you can have both. I mean, certainly I've seen great rabbis and thinkers who are moderate in their ideology but passionate in their fulfillment and their connection to religiosity. Sociologically, a lot of people align with various branches or sub-branches based on lifestyle and identify with modern orthodoxy because it's quote-unquote easier. Which is a danger, and I think it's a statement that modern orthodoxy has to make more clearly. I'll just end with this very quickly. I remember Noah Feldman, I don't know if you remember, professor who intermarried, who went to Maimonides, wrote The Orthodox Paradox. At the time, I wrote an article which was published in Art Sheva online, which said that, you know, his justification of what he did of intermarrying and saying it fits right into the modern Orthodox approach, that's what he said, is something that, if we look more carefully at what other people say, is not so different. I just give an example, and it's somewhat controversial, but try to understand what I'm saying. I once had a teacher who was very serious as in Israel, same school that I spoke about before in the previous talk, who went to a musical where women were singing. And I asked him what allowed him to do such a thing. And there are reasons. One can find legitimation for this position halakha. And he looked at me strangely as if, what kind of question is that? Of course we can do it. We're modern. And I think that ultimately that's not so different than what Feldman is saying. And I think this is a dangerous, slippery slope that modern Orthodox rabbis have to schreie gewalt and say, that's not what we are. You want an easy road, try something else. Thanks.